Oh, hello, hello.
Hello.
And welcome to the New York Mystery Machine.
Tammany Hall, but for the ghosts.
But for all the ghosts, Christina's nice and quiet in her her
as
tone today.
As ever. I'm slowly creeping in how I modulate my voice, though. I've been trying to monitor it when I listen back. We're getting there. Also, I pressed record properly today. I mean, this time.
Yeah, we had it, but I counted us in four times.
Yeah.
The first three times, Christina's like, It's not recording.
I don't know why. It turned out I was pressing stop.
Yeah, and stop generally doesn't record things.
Record.
It usually just stops them, oddly enough. Welcome to the show, everyone. We are having a swimming time here on our road trip month. Doing a lot of fun stuff. It's been such a blast to get out of New York for a little bit. We were both literally out of New York last week.
True. Where were you, Adam?
I was in the Isles of Ticks and Caicos.
Very exotic.
Oh my gosh. It was my first time out of the country in 20 years.
How did that
feel? It was just good. It was just so peaceful and wonderful. And the water was just tremendous and clear blue waters. And it was just the best. And all the humans I was with, I think, are going to listen to our show now because I really sold it to them. So.
Excellent. I really appreciate it.
I think they were all listening to the pilot.
Life.
So,
your social life is really a vehicle.
You guys know I use my social life, my dating life. I use it all to get people to listen to the show. It's all a charade. Like, you know, yes, you can date me. Yes, you could be friends with me. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you rather just listen to my podcast?
Right.
I also realized I have TMJ. That's a fun thing I've developed. I developed some TMJ. So, my mouth is not feeling great today.
It was getting
better, and then the last 2 days of this cold, damp weather just like was like, oh, you're not, no. Mm-mm, and so now it's just really. So I'm gonna just, you know, do my thing today.
Oh God. Well, that's awful.
It developed when I was in Turks and Caicos. I was like, why does my jaw hurt me?
Maybe
and then
all
I looked
the
it up.
Tension just came and like you were relaxed, so the tension came to the fore. How does that work?
I don't know, but I was like. I looked it up on the way home. I was like, is this TMJ? And then I looked at the images. I was like, oh, this is clearly TMJ. It's right on the joint. Like, it's exactly where the TMJ pictures are.
Oh, no.
It's like, I think this is exactly where the TMJ photo says that the TMJ hits. The TMJ spot, as one would.
As one calls it, the TMJ spot.
The TMJ spot. Well, again, welcome to the show, everyone. We're enjoying this road trip, and we know that you guys have been enjoying the road trip. And if you have been feeling any certain way about this road trip, we'd love to hear from you. And the best way of doing that is reaching out to us on our Hot Take Hotline. Christina, do you remember the number?
I was just going to see if I could test myself. It is, I'm going to look to you for validation, 462. No, give me a second. 4-2.
No. No. Stop it. No, stop talking. You're all wrong. 917.
Oh. 462.
Yeah.
4-2.
Yep.
6-2.
There it is. Like, you need an area code. A New York area code.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
917-462-4262 is our Hot Take Hotline. Dial
in. I got 2/3 of it right.
Let us know some of your hot takes on the show, whether it be from the last couple of episodes on our road trip, whether it be from episodes 1 through 130. Let us know. We'd love to hear your theories. Also, let us know your haunted tales. They don't have to be just in New York. If you have any stories, paranormal stories, alien stories, weird stories, just weird happenstances, doesn't matter where you have them, we'd love to hear from you. Head over to nymysterymachine.com and there's a link in there to share your story. We'd love to hear from you.
Don't be confined by arbitrary borders.
No one should. Borders are just made up. We made those up.
We did.
We just made them up. We're like, we're going to give you this land and we're going to take this. Also, be sure to follow us on all our socials at NY Mystery Machine on Instagram and Facebook and TikTok and at NY Mysteries on the X. I think that's all the places you can follow us currently. Also, Patreon, new Patreon dropping this month. It's directly connected to episode, to the first episode of the road trip, the Bud episode. So be sure to, oh, Christina, you got all blurry. I can't see Ed now. What's the point of living? I can't see Ed Harley in the background.
There you go.
I mean, you can blur yourself, which is really funny. All of a sudden, you got the screen just went blurry.
I was getting distracted. So
that's fair. No, that's fair. Then you blur if you need to blur. And so that there, the patron episode this month is connected to our first road trip episode of the month. So be sure to check it out for the last $5 a month. I also reminded everyone, the last week was the anniversary of the Titanic sinking, and we did a whole Patreon exclusive on some Titanic conspiracy theories, and that's also on the Patreon at the $5 level. That. Yeah, we did it around the time that the submersive, sunk or died, you know, exploded, imploded. Yeah. So, if you're interested in all crazy Titanic things, it's a really fun little episode about crazy Titanic conspiracy theories, only available on our Patreon at the $5 level. Well, Christina, where are we at today in the country?
We are not in the country today.
Oh, my word. Where are we going?
We've gone international.
Well, thank God. I'm used to traveling now. I have my passport. I'm good to go.
I was going
to
say, saying we're not in the country no longer means anything because we did take a flight to Venus a few weeks ago.
I mean, yeah, we were in a different dimension.
Today, we are in France.
France. I'm going on a date with a girl from France today.
Are you?
Right after this episode.
Don't let her listen to this episode because we're going to be using French accents.
The entire time we are talking in French accents. I did my French accent for her on WhatsApp, and it went as well as I thought it would.
Which was excellent. Poorly. And she loved it.
She's like, it sounds like a German accent. I'm like, yeah, I know. They all sound the same.
It's Alsace Lorraine, you know.
Hello. Welcome to the France. With the croissant and the baguette.
I hope you said exactly that.
Yeah, yeah. That's what French people say.
All the time.
That's what they talk about all the time.
I just think of the Flight of the Conchords thing. Où est la piscine?
I don't watch Flight of the Conchords.
Well, you should.
No, yeah, well, I don't want to now.
Well,
I don't take any recommendations.
We're just going to press stop on this whole thing. make you go watch.
All right,
it.
We're in France. What are you doing in France?
And we're specifically in Renaissance France. We have I keep feeling
Renaissance?
Like Renaissance France?
France? Where is that in France?
Well, it is the 1500s, I should say. That kind of Renaissance, but we're
an era. Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, this is a place in France?
Weird that they would. Is there also a Baroque France? No. we are in the 1500s France specifically.
Fucking museum snob. Is there a Baroque?
And the main figure in today's story begins his life in the Basque region of France. So, Basque country is a
Basque country.
I wanted to create that song after this
episode. Basque country.
Basque country is a region in the Western Pyrenees, in which the Basque people, go figure, have historically lived. It also has parts that are claimed today by both France and Spain. The political situation is a little bit different in both areas. So Basque regions under Spanish control have some degree of political autonomy, which is lacking, as I understand it, in French Basque areas. And there are many in Basque country who are seeking even greater autonomy. There's a separatist movement, sometimes that has resulted in violence. Also things that are important to understand today is that Basque culture and language is somewhat to very different from French and Spanish culture. And it's absolutely different from French and Spanish linguistically. And that's actually pretty crucial to today's story. So hold on to this information. The Basque language, well, you don't need this particular bit of information, but I think it's cool. The Basque language is a language isolate, which means it does not have a relationship to any other known, extinct, or current language. It just sort of, whereas, like, you know, English is a cousin of German, right? Or French is a cousin of Italian. Basque just sort of shows up. And my understanding is that it is actually the only surviving language isolate in Europe. And I could absolutely go on 100% of the time just talking about the cultural linguistic side of Basque things because I think this is really cool, but we've ceased the important part of this for today's story, so we're just going to move on. The other area that is important to today's story isn't that far away. It is Artigat. which is a commune in southwestern France in an area known as the Languedoc. Now, Artigat is about an hour's drive from the city of Toulouse, and about 3.5 hours from, and I'm hoping I'm saying this right, Hendaye, which is a coastal Basque town that sits on the French side of the modern border with Spain. So the meat of our story today occurs around the year 1556. So important to know for this time period, right? France and Spain are constantly at each other's throats, militarily speaking. The Catholic Church is the be-all, end-all of most people's life, with the exception of the growing Protestant movement. Increasingly, Protestants are popping up all over Europe. And in France, for example, the Huguenots, a Protestant sect, would be embedded within the Languedoc region until they were expelled. So there's also lots of interreligious strife and violence around this era. Mm-hmm. So that situates us geographically and historically. And the primary person of today's story is a guy named Martin Guerre.
Martin Guerre.
Martin Guerre. Born Martin.
Hello.
Hello. My name is Martin Guerre. He was born Martin Daguerre to a man named Sanxi Daguerre. Now, Daguerre is a Basque name.
And Daguerre. We were in the Midwest last week, so I just had a feel.
You had to. I get it.
I had to throw them one.
Daguerre is a Basque name, and Martin was born in that commune we mentioned earlier, Hendaye, in 1524. But he moves with his family to Artigat in the Languedoc region when he was pretty young, probably around 1527. So you got to imagine he's like, what, 3 years old. So in order to be accepted into their new home, the Daguerres begin to adopt some Languedoc customs. So, for instance, that's when they choose the more French-sounding name Guerre to be their last name. They would also have learned and begun to use Languedoc, the local dialect. They would have gotten increasingly used to a society wherein the written word was used with some degree of frequency, which is not so with their native Basque. But some things, like Martin's name, would have really made them stick out and continue to mark him as a very Basque individual. Martin, though a very French name today, right, was very uncommon in the Languedoc region at the time, even though it was a very common Basque name. In the Languedoc, you're more likely to find names like Arnaud and Antoine's and Bernard's. And according to Natalie Zeman Davis, an historian whose work is best known for her contributions to a movie that's actually based on today's story, quote, Martin was what the peasants called an animal, an ass, and in local tradition, the bear that the shepherds saw up in the mountains. So there are these things that would have continued to mark the family as very different and other, which may contribute to some of what's about to happen. This idea that maybe they are outsiders, and even if they are accepted in the community, you can imagine kids teasing Martin as he grows up. In 1538, Martin Guerre, Sanxi's only son, marries Bertrande de Rolles, the daughter of the Rolles family, which was a pretty well-off family in Artigat. They had a lot of properties around the area, and this is a really good, advantageous marriage. It's likely that Bertrand would have come with a really good dowry, perhaps roughly the price of a field or a small vineyard, and it was probably paid in cash and maybe even came with an actual piece of land. And in addition, at this time, you know, she would have come with clothes and household goods like a bed and feather pillows and bed covers. And you can just sort of imagine the slightly Renaissance affluent version of the scene in Fiddler on the Roof, where they're just bringing out the, you know, all the things that are coming for for the wedding. Unusual, however, were the ages of Martin and Bertrand. So Martin was probably 14, and Bertrand would later claim that she was only like 9 or 10, which, for all we think of the Renaissance period, was actually illegal even at the time. Like in the
to be 14 years old.
Getting married at 9 or 10.
It's illegal to be 14.
Up until you're 15, you're
just skip really illegal. You have to 14. It's 13, 15. It's 13, 13, 15, or 13, 15, 15.
Right, your
There's
choice.
No 14.
Mm-hmm. No, the idea that she was 9 or 10 at the time of this marriage would have been illicit. But here we are. That's what she claims she was. there was a custom that would have meant that there was a whole wedding procession from the church back to the house of Martin's father, Sangxi, where they would have danced and eaten and feasted, and then the couple would have been accompanied to the marriage bed, and specifically they would have been given a spiced drink with all sorts of herbs and spices to act as a sort of aphrodisiac and hopefully get Bertrand pregnant very, 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 very quickly. But in the words of Natalie Davis, that historian, quote, "Nothing happened in Bertrand's marriage bed, it seemed, neither that night nor for 8 years afterward. Martin Guerre was impotent. The couple had been cast under a spell. This was probably shocking. Martin was growing up tall and slender and was good at swordplay and acrobatics. Bertrand was beautiful. And yet Martin was impotent, and Bertrand would later claim she was bewitched by the same spell." She goes on to write, "Now, witches ordinarily dealt only with the male organ when trying to prevent intercourse between husband and wife, but it could happen to a woman. As explained by the inquisitors in the Malleus Maleficarum, the devil can so darken the wife's understanding that she considers her husband so loathsome that not for all the world would she allow him to lie with her," unquote. And this whole situation would have been humiliating to them. And also weirdly public, because marriages without a pregnancy after a certain period of time were often openly mocked in a sort of, like, they would have like this parade where people dress up and then come to your house and like taunt you outside, which sounds
But they're also children.
They're also children. But then you have to imagine that for 8 years, right?
When they are still children.
When they're still children. But the idea is that by then they should have really been pregnant. Because the assumption is that by the time, even though she's 9 or 10 when she's married, she probably wouldn't have been married off unless she was already experiencing her menstrual cycle. So Bertrand's family is at this point pressuring her to leave Martin. They're like, "You haven't consummated this marriage.
Leave this man. You don't need him. You're 9 years old. The future is yours."
And basically that is what they're saying, especially by the time, what, she's probably maybe getting closer to 17 or 18 at this point. They're like, for the love of
God. Oh, now she's too old. No, now she's too old.
Well, right. Now we're getting into dangerous territory.
Now you're an old maid.
Get the heck out of here. This is going to be bad. And at the moment, because the assumption is they haven't even consummated their marriage, she can still get an annulment. Right. And that's important, because that means she might be able to remarry and have kids, which is like the ultimate goal in this time period. If you want any degree of security as a woman, you need to be married and have some kids. And so all of a sudden around this time, a witch again emerges or something like that and takes the spell off, because Bertrand ends up pregnant, and they have their son, Sangxi. And this brings us to the year 1548. Sangxi Jr. is a few months old. Martin is about 24, and Martin does something crazy. He steals a small amount of grain from his father, which doesn't sound especially bad, but to the Basque, this is unthinkable. This is unforgivable. And so in the words of a roughly contemporary account of the time, Martin Guerre would leave, quote, "for fear of the severity of his parents," unquote. And no one would hear again from him for years. He just ups and disappears into the night, and everyone's like, where the fuck is Martin? And this is life-shattering for Bertrand, because it's worse and bigger than impotence. She is now without any protection. She's got this tiny kid. She's not a widow. She's not married. She's basically statusless in the society. And at this point, what's really frustrating is that she no longer has the option to get annulled, right? There's this law, basically, that says that even if your husband has abandoned you for 20 years, you can't technically say that he's dead. Unless you have proof he's dead, you're just still in this limbo marriage with this absentee person. So meanwhile, you know, she's taken into the family, you know, Martin's uncle, Martin's parents die in the intervening years. She's taken in by the uncle who also marries her mother, which is a little bit of like a my own grandpa situation, if you ask me, but here we are. And this goes on for a decade, from 1548 to 1556, at which point Martin Guerre reemerges in a nearby village. He shows up at a hotel. He says, "Hello, I'm Martin Guerre." And the hotel says, "Have you been abandoning your wife and child all this time?" And he suddenly like bursts into tears, like missing his family so deeply. And so the word spreads that this guy who'd vanished for an actual decade is just up and over here. And the family goes running. They go running to see him. Like, we know how difficult it is for, like, we've covered a lot of missing person cases. Yeah. This is Renaissance France. There was probably no hope that you would ever see Martin Guerre again.
No, he's gone.
He's gone.
He's probably dead someplace.
That's what they probably were assuming, even though they couldn't do anything about it. But they come running, and the sisters run up and grab him and hug him. And Bertrand sort of recoils initially and looks at him like, I don't know who the fuck you are.
Who are you?
Who are you? But Martin starts to talk to her sweetly. He remembers these very specific, intimate things about them. And so finally she says, you know, I guess I just didn't recognize you with this new beard of yours. It's you. It's fine. And she, you know, they take him home. Now, when they go back to Artigat, Martin continues to identify people by name. He's talking to them about issues that they argued over 10 years ago or 15 years ago when he was still growing up. And he claims that in these intervening years, what he did was he ran off to serve in the army for the King of France, and now he's just so happy to be home with his 8-year-old son. And they begin to live happily together. They conceive another child, a daughter they named Bernard. Martin is able to claim his inheritance that he was left by his family. And here's the beginning of the problem. He not only claims his inheritance, he says to his uncle, I'd like to get all the profits you made on my inheritance while I was MIA.
Oh, boy.
And Uncle Pierre is like, what the fuck? and so Martin sues Pierre for this, and Pierre starts to get really ticked. And what's bad is that he starts to think about, would Martin ever do this to me? Would my nephew do this to me? And you know what? This guy doesn't really even look like my nephew. I don't think this guy is my nephew. This
guy doesn't look like my nephew. I don't know. 10 years can change a man.
This fucking guy. And he starts spreading the word that actually, this isn't Martin at all. This guy's an imposter.
An imposter.
And that's where things get real bad for Martin. After the break.
We'll be right back after this little break. Let's talk about Audible.
Yes. Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers to memoirs, news, business, and more. And now you can start your own free trial by heading to www.audibletrial.com/NY Mystery Machine.
Your free 30-day trial comes with 1 credit, 2 credit for Amazon Prime members, good for any premium selection titles you like, yours to keep. The Audible Plus catalog consists of podcasts, audiobooks, guided wellness, and Audible originals. Listen all you want, no credits needed.
Audible allows you to download titles and listen offline, anytime, anywhere. Perfect for long trips or even cozy afternoons to yourself.
The app is free and can be installed on smartphones and tablets, and you can listen across devices without losing your spot.
I just recently checked out The Mad Sculptor by Harold Schechter, which we based a whole episode on.
You're darn right we did. And I'm sure they have even more true crime and paranormal books in the collection as well.
Again, Audible isn't just audiobooks. They have podcasts, guided wellness programs, theatrical performances, A-list comedy, and exclusive Audible originals you won't find anywhere else.
Wait, podcast? Does that include the New York Mystery Machine?
Sure does. To start your free 30-day trial, head to www.audibletrial.com/NY Mystery Machine.
That's www.audibletrial.com/NY Mystery Machine. The New York Mystery Machine is brought to you in part by listeners like you.
That's right. Head on over to our Patreon, and for as little as $3 a month, you can help keep the pod growing.
By joining, you can access a whole bunch of cool stuff, such as mini episodes, swag, exclusive playlists, and more.
Head to www.patreon.com/NY Mystery Machine to find out more and become a patron.
That's www.patreon.com/NY Mystery Machine and join our ever-growing community today. And we're back.
We're back. We learned all about Basque Country. We learned all about 16th century Languedoc. And we've learned that Martin Guerre, having disappeared for 10 years, has come back, reclaimed his inheritance. And now his uncle's like, actually, I don't think it's the same guy. And there were some things that were really different about Martin. So, for example, he no longer seemed to remember any Basque phrases, or just a few Basque phrases. I remember this would have been the native language of his childhood, at least for the first 3 years. He no longer seemed to be interested in, like, acrobatics, but, you know, people outgrow their interests. And his uncle was also like, wasn't Martin kind of slender? This Martin is pretty stocky by comparison. But again, people change after 10 years. So Pierre convinces his wife, again, remember, this is now Bertrand's mom, that actually this isn't Martin at all. And they decide to pressure Bertrand to bring a case against the imposter. And to make clear what's at stake here, right? If Martin isn't Martin, then Bertrand is living in sin. And worse, she is an adulterer. And if that's not really ringing as, like, the greatest problem on earth to you, in this time period, in this area, to assume someone else's identity in order to defraud was a serious crime, you could be faced with fines, physical punishment, and death. And adultery... adultery.
That's insane.
Yeah, right? Adultery in this time period was also punishable by death. So Bertrand, if she's convicted of having no...
I bet the guys get off free a lot, though.
Probably. Probably more so than the women.
I bet that adultery doesn't stick for those dudes. The women, though, every single one's murdered. Every single one's put to death.
Almost certainly. Almost 100%.
You look at... You step out on your husband, murder. You look at another man, murder. You go down to the street for a baguette and you see another man, murder. You sneeze and another man says, bless you, murder.
You slept with another man's wife and you are a man?
It's fine. It was probably for reasons. You know, sometimes you need to see another person. Just to see how it is. I had this person for so many years. I want to know how this other person is. Then you know. This is okay, for we are in France. But if she do, it's murder.
Murder. So this is what's at stake, right? Bertrand's...
The French accent's not terrible. The French accent's not terrible, you guys.
You gotta ask our newest listener, the French lady you're about to go on a date with.
I'm gonna be like, I just spent 30 minutes doing a really bad French accent in preparation for this.
I want you to do the whole date.
It's method acting.
Accent. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, hello, and welcome to the New York Mystery Machine. With the baguettes and the cigarette, the wines.
So Bertrand is in a rock and a hard place. She seems to be having a great old time with this Martin Guerre, but her family is like, "You girl, you're probably going to get put to death if we can prove that this guy is not who he says he is. So get ready." And in fact, the family tries to, like, club Martin to death. And Bertrand throws herself in front of the situation, and she's quoted as saying, "He is Martin Guerre, my husband, or else some devil in his skin. I know him well. If anyone is so mad as to say the contrary, I'll make him die." So very aggravated language all around with everyone. But in 1559, a few things sort of really ramp up here. So a soldier who had known Martin Guerre during the battle portion of Martin's life shows up and passes nearby town, takes a look at the guy and says, "That's not Martin.
That is not Martin. I was soldier with him."
And everyone's like, "Well, how do you know?" And the soldier's like, "Because Martin lost his leg. We had to amputate." You can't hear, but Adam looks delighted by this information. Well, maybe not delighted. Not delighted at the loss of the leg.
This feels like information we should have known like 30 minutes ago.
It's a big reveal. You're living it in, like, real time.
This girl, and also this girl is clearly like, "I don't give a fuck. This guy fucks good." Because she's like, "I don't know. The leg is back. It's either a miracle or he's lying to me." I don't know.
Well, no. She wouldn't have known, because the soldier claims Martin lost his leg in battle, right? And during those intervening 10 years.
Oh, during the intervening years.
Yes.
So he knew Martin after he abandoned his family.
Right, exactly. He knows Martin from their soldiering days together. And God, during those soldiering, okay. Bertrand's not just completely like
obtuse. Like, I don't know.
This guy's like a lizard, just grew back his leg.
He misses his leg, but maybe that's okay.
That would be very funny. No. So this guy's like, no, Martin lost his leg. This guy has both of them. And they're like, oh, that's not great. And then another villager from a not too far away town comes through and says, I know that guy. His name is Arnaud Dutil. We call him
Pancette. Arnaud.
We call him Pancette, which means like the belly. He's this man who's known for being honey-tongued and charming and having like this really voracious appetite for all things, worldly. Apparently, Arnaud Dutil is a charlatan. He's clever. He swears. He's a petty thief. He's a womanizer. And that's him. I don't know who Martin is, but that's Arnaud Dutil. So Pierre starts to gather all this information, and he takes it to a local judge. He pretends to be doing so initially on Bertrand's behalf. Bertrand's like, to your point, she's like, I don't know. This guy fucks real good. We're just gonna stick this out.
Like, I clearly know he's not my husband, but like whatever.
She's not interested now. Basically how she's rolling with this. But eventually, because Pierre brings this suit that he claims is on her behalf, she's sort of forced into having to go along with this, right? And according to the historian, there's some debate as to whether she is going along to try to make the best of any outcome, right? So that if he's convicted of being an imposter, she can be like, oh no, I went along with the lawsuit, please don't kill me. And if he's not convicted of being an imposter, she can be like, thank God, I was really enjoying this marriage. So Adam, I'm going to start to give you some additional evidence and some 16th century legalese, and I would like you to use this information to render your verdict before I tell you what the court decides.
Whether if he's an imposter or not?
Exactly. The question is going to be whether this is, in fact, Martin Guerre or an imposter who willingly and knowingly deceives everyone. So, over the course of the trial, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of witnesses. They start, like, getting everyone they could possibly find to testify. And so, here I'm going to read from Natalie Zeman Davis's book, because I think she writes it very compellingly. Again, recall that this whole scenario is a matter of actual life and death for a couple of people involved. Quote, here, where the honor and life of a man were at stake, the proof was supposed to be certain, indubitable, and clearer than day. But how in a time without photographs, with few portraits, without tape recorders, without fingerprinting, without identity cards, without birth certificates, without parish records are still irregular if kept at all, how did one establish a person's identity beyond doubt? You could test the man's memory, though there's always the possibility that he had been coached. You could ask witnesses to identify him and hope that they were accurate and truthful. You could consider special marks on his face and body, but their significance could only be established by witnesses who recollected the earlier person. You could look to see whether he resembled other members of the family. You could check his handwriting, but only if he and the earlier person could both write and you had samples of the latter's work. The court of Rieux had to try to extract some kind of truth from such evidence, and henceforth the discourse of the villagers about Martin Guerre would be bent to its purposes. So at least 45 people that they interview swear that the prisoner is Arnaud Dutil, a.k.a. Pancette, or at least not Martin Guerre. 30 to 40 people say this is absolutely Martin Guerre, including Martin's sisters, two brothers-in-law, and one of the women who had carried that aphrodisiac drink to Martin and Bertrand on their wedding night. 60-plus witnesses say, we're not sure. I don't know either way. This is too much. The judge was feeling a little at a loss, and so he demanded an evaluation of the resemblance of the prisoner to Martin Guerre's family. And according to that assessment, the prisoner did not resemble Martin's sons, Sanxi, but did resemble Martin's sisters. Handwriting test out the window. Neither Arnaud Dutil nor Martin Guerre had ever written anything prior to this whole debacle, so nothing to compare to. As for the present individual having forgotten seemingly his native Basque, one could say that that is because, again, imposter. Or maybe Martin Guerre was just young, right? He was about 3 when he moved to Attigat. Maybe Basque wasn't being used as much, and, you know, you forget your childhood language sometimes. Some folks swear that they had learned from that soldier that Martin Guerre had a wooden leg now, but that's hearsay. And Arnold Dutille, that possible imposter, individual, was described as being wicked. But the present individual had lived in Artigat a very honorable life, all things considered. Now, legally, there's precedent that, quote, it was better to leave unpunished a guilty person than to condemn an innocent one. And furthermore, there was a precedent in French courts that when in doubt during a case, you should rule in favor of a situation that supports a marriage and children. And in this particular case, it's worth noting that there is both a marriage to Bertrand and the parentage of Sancy and
the new baby,
Bernard. So, Adam, that's the overview of the evidence. And this goes on for months, but that's the overview of the evidence. There are two questions here. What do you think is going on? And what did the courts rule?
I think that this man met the real Martin during the years. Martin died, and he just assumed his identity.
And how do you think the courts rule?
Whether it be by malfeasance, like whether it be like, I shouldn't be doing this, but I'm going to do it, or whether it was like, I need you to go back to my family. Because, like, you know, he finds his exact family. Like, it's a whole, like, he finds the exact town. He knows enough about Martin to find where he is. You know, this is not 2024 when people already have all their information on them. It's like, he manages to find them. So I think that whoever this person is, he, like, connects with. And mm-hmm. either he learns enough about him to assume that life, or he's like, I'm dying, I need you to go back and assume my life. So either it's altruistic or not. I think the courts vote that he's the real Martin.
You think the courts say that this is Martin Guerre?
Yes.
Okay. So, and I think to your point too about like the difference between 2024 and 1560 is really important too, because he does go up to people and identify them, right? It's not even always necessarily that they're like, hey, remember me? I'm Claude. Yeah. He's like, hey, Claude, remember that time? So the first trial actually results in a guilty conviction.
Ooh.
And they're like, nope, imposter.
Imposter.
Imposter. But the prisoner swiftly appeals it. And they do all of this sort of interviewing again. At the second trial, the court begins to lean in favor of declaring the prisoner Martin Guerre. Remember also there's this whole issue of marriage and children at stake. And they're like, you know what? Why do this to people? But then something absolutely extraordinary happens that makes it impossible to rule accordingly.
Oh.
Up the doors of the Parliament building in Toulouse comes a man with a wooden leg.
Oh,
claiming
my.
To be Martin Guerre.
What? I did. That is the biggest turn a story has ever taken.
Right.
I did not. I usually foresee big things coming. I did not foresee the real Martin coming in through the door.
Peg leg and all.
My whole theory is in jeopardy right now.
So here's what we know now to have happened based on Martin Guerre's own testimony.
I am the real Martin Guerre.
Martin apparently, way back when, had crossed the Pyrenees, learned to speak Castilian. He becomes a lackey in a cardinal's household in the city of Burgos, which is this big, bustling city, which is so different from Artigat in its countryside. Martin then became a servant in the cardinal's brother's household, Pedro. And Pedro is involved with the Spanish army. So Martin does, in fact, become a soldier, but he becomes a soldier for the Spanish army. He goes to Flanders as part of Philip II's campaign against the French, which means that he is treasonous and is fighting against his own people. And on August 10th, 1557, Martin Guerre was hit in the leg during battle by a French arquebus, some sort of long gun, which necessitated that his leg be amputated. Which, for the record, if we think about the Civil War amputations as being horrific, I can't imagine what an amputation in 1557 looks like.
My God, yeah.
Pretty bad.
You just, yeah.
So the individual in the courthouse who had been living as Martin Guerre now for at least 3 years was none other than Arnold Dutille, that charlatan, who had heard about Martin and his family somehow in his own travels with the French army and had decided to take on the identity for himself. Why? Unclear. probably the promise of an inheritance and a new and respectable life. Although the historian we've been quoting, Natalie Zeman Davis, speculates that maybe Bertrand was complicit because it gives her this chance for a, you know, to be a wife with social status, and, you know, maybe they actually develop some kind of romance. Why Martin Guerre decides now to show up?
Well, maybe he hears tell.
He hears tell. Almost certainly, right?
I mean, I think word gets around that this missing man is no longer missing. This, you know, esteemed man has returned to his family. It's like, wait a minute, I abandoned my family. I don't want them to have people in their lives.
Which is kind of a crazy thing as well, right?
It's like he also comes back. He's like, hey, I know what I did wasn't great, but I did it. And so someone who's not me can't undo it. Okay, so
he really is.
How dare you undo the damage I did to my family? How dare you?
How dare you? You give my son a father? No,
you scallywag! How dare you?
But that's basically it. Like word must have gotten to Martin, who was off living his life, and he was like, no, no one else gets to bed my wife and raise my son, and so he shows back up. And so in July 1560, Martin Guerre has the opportunity to confront the imposter, Arnaud Dutille, and Bertrand. So his wife is brought before him. And according to the chronicler upon whose account Natalie Zeman Davis bases much of her work, Bertrand trembles upon seeing him and weeps hysterically and runs to him crying, begging for forgiveness, saying that she only ever believed that the imposter was him because she so desperately wanted to have him back, and because his sisters and his uncle and all these other people were so ready to believe that it was him that she just gave in. And Martin Guerre apparently says this: Adam, I'm gonna send this to you, and I would love you to read this in your very best accent.
I can tell you what I wish happened. I wish the end of the story is, and then she's executed. I don't want it to happen, but it feels so 1560s France. It just feels like 1560s France. And then she's executed on the spot.
They give Martin the permission to just behead her. Here is what Martin says.
Oh, new character alert, you guys.
Mm-hmm. Remember, you're a 1560s one-legged family abandoner Frenchman.
Hold on, let me take the stand. Hold on, let me take the stand. That's my peg leg.
Incredible.
Leave aside these tears, and don't excuse yourself by my sisters nor my uncle, for there's neither father, mother, uncle, sister, brother who ought to know their son, nephew, or brother than the wife ought to know her husband. And the disaster which has befallen our house, no one is to blame by you. You dick.
Right?
You dick. You left them, you fucker.
Right?
You're blaming her. You up and left your family, you douche. This is all your fault. But didn't you leave us? No, wait a minute. And sometimes you need to leave to go fight the wars. Make your good. The accent took a turn.
I don't know where we are anymore.
I think I was in Spain at that point.
He did spend, you know, you're just really.
And he's
you're
a little,
really
he's a little Spanish
us.
Now. He's a little yeah. Spanish now. What a joke.
It is the most incredible response. It's incredible. And apparently, to the court's credit, the court was like, Martin, you know, you're kind of also to blame. Like, don't pretend like you're not to blame. And
but what did Martin de Guerre do? He just went on the little walkabout. He went to fight a little war. And
remember,
then
that was a treasonous war, Martin. Do you remember that?
It wasn't my fault. You see, sometimes you're in the midst of the war and you don't know who you're fighting. Is it friend? Is it foe? You just need to take your baguette and your rifle and your shot, but not with the baguette. That is for snack.
Oh,
Why do you guys listen to us?
I think your Martin Guerre is my new favorite of your characters.
This has been, this last few months, I think it's been a renaissance of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sassy German, Martin Guerre.
You're welcome.
The superintendent.
For providing.
Mm-hmm. I forgot the superintendent. He hasn't even come back yet. He'll come back soon.
So at this point, the court doesn't need a confession. They don't need any further proof. Dutil is condemned. He's forced to give a public apology in Artigat. And
he's like, okay, look, what I did was not good, but this motherfucker left his family and you just praising him? Some bullshit.
I hope that's what he said. I hope that were his dying words.
This is some bullshit. He's smoking my cigarette. I'm really pissed about this. It was a full, it was a good plan. It was a good plan.
So he's sentenced to give a public apology, and then he was to be hanged. And his body was going to be burned, quote, so that the memory of so miserable and abominable a person would disappear completely and be lost, unquote.
Oh my God.
Now, apparently this was altogether a relatively merciful sentence from the court, because he could have been tortured, and he could have been, had his daughter named illegitimate. But instead, they decided that his daughter would be considered legitimate despite everything, and he wasn't going to be tortured, and Bertrand was not going to be prosecuted for fraud, bigamy, or adultery. They decided that because she was a weak and fragile woman with poorer intellect than that of a man, she was just easily deceived, and so here we are.
It's like it's okay, hon, your brain is so small, it's not your fault. It's just not your fault. We get it. We get it. You're emotional. Your brain's a little smaller. He came in with his big hairy chest, and you're like, "Oh, this is my man." We get it.
They also decided not to prosecute the actual Martin Guerre for abandonment. They felt instead that his long sojourn was
a break. I took a little vacation. This is not abandoned.
That's exactly what they say. They're like, you were young. You were just like, you know, sowing your wild oats. We get it. And they decide that, like, his whole being treasonous and fighting against his own country wasn't something to worry about either, because he had been a lackey in this guy's household. So he really just fulfilled his vow of obedience by fighting in his, you know, his household person's war. Arnaud de Thiel makes his apology. He begs forgiveness of Bertrand, whom he said was a woman of honor and virtue, and who had driven him away the moment she suspected what he had done. And he asked forgiveness of God, and then he was killed.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Thereafter, it seems Bertrand and Martin got on again with the business of living. By the time Martin dies in 1594, he's got a couple more sons with Bertrand. I can't imagine what that marriage looked like. And that is the story of Martin Guerre that was pieced together centuries later from all these random archival bits. It's actually been turned into a movie, which I highly recommend. It has Gérard Depardieu playing the imposter Arnaud de Thiel. It's been turned into novels. I think there's even an opera or an operetta about it. And to this day, according to Natalie Zeman Davis, when villagers in Artigat talk about how nothing ever happens here, the older folk in the town say, perhaps not now, but in the 1500s, and proceed to tell the story.
Well, there you have it.
That's the return of Martin Guerre.
Oh my gosh.
I know you didn't know where this was headed, but I think it's worth it for that reveal of Martin Guerre coming up the steps.
You guys, I was like, where is this episode heading?
It's really just Christina going through a renaissance romp.
At one point I was like, sometimes we ask each other what the episode's about, and today we didn't. And I was just like, I wonder what this episode's about, because we're about 20 minutes in, and I'm just like learning about like the Renaissance.
Yeah. This was all just a vehicle for me to talk about Renaissance France. You're lucky I spared you some of the finer details of the difference between Basque country life and French country life.
Well, there you have it, folks. Well, we'd love to know your thoughts on this and all our other cases. You can head over to the Hot Take Hotline at 917-462-4262. You can drop us an email at nymysterymachine@gmail.com or reach out to us on our social media. While you're on the internet, be sure to drop us 5 stars and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, wherever you listen to your podcast. Join our Patreon for as less $3 a month. That's patreon.com/nymysterymachine. Be sure to buy some merch, nymysterymachine.com. And yeah, just head over to nymysterymachine.com for all your New York Mystery Machine wants and needs. We have one more week on the road, you guys, and then we head on back to New York in May. And we're finishing out a road trip with a very infamous American story. And ooh, so
I don't know what it is. I don't know what anything about what Adam's got planned.
It will be a doozy. In any case,
I do have a request.
Oh yeah,
I have a request that you re-record our road trip theme, but with a little French twist.
Dum 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 da ga dum ga ga dum 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 da ga dum ga ga dum 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 ram po po ru tu ta ra dum 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 za road trip.
That is exactly what I wanted. You read my mind.
I've been Adam Mace.
I've been Christina Marinelli.
And thank you ever so much for taking a ride on the New York Mystery Machine.
Damn in the hell, but the costs.